Okay, my name's John Edgar. I'm assistant head teacher at the Dean's School, which is in Thundersley in Essex.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, parents and schooling?
My schooling, fairly standard schooling. I was brought up in this area. I haven't always lived in this area. I sort of moved away and then came back again. But my home background was in the local area. Went to the local schools. Went to one of the local comprehensive schools, which is about 4 or 5 miles from here in Rayleigh. And fairly standard schooling background. Went to the local sixth form college, then went on and did my degree in history and education, then started to teach, and here we are.
Okay.
Basically, but home background, I suppose my parents are fairly typical of this area in the fact that probably both of them came from what would today, I suppose we would term as fairly standard working class backgrounds, in one in South and one in East London, and came out to live in Essex in the 50s.
Can you remember anything about the way you were taught history at school?
Oh yes, and I can remember even the people who taught me history in school, because I've had the enviable reputation of being one of those people who, the person who taught me history when I was in the first year at school, then was my line manager in my last school, and is now a head teacher in the local area who I work quite closely with, and he's also quite a close personal friend of mine. So I can tell you a little bit about without blushing to him. Fairly typical of the time, pretty much what we would call a transference of a body of knowledge sort of teaching, or transposed with one or two fairly gifted teachers. Oh, I look back now, obviously not made that judgment at the time, but people who were maybe a little bit ahead of their time and who taught perhaps in a little bit more in the sort of way that we would hope that history would be taught today. I had a fairly traditional secondary school introduction to history. I can't really remember much about history at primary school. I don't know if we actually did any, or whether it was just submerged, but of course I was that generation of people that were taught and was like a project based approach to learning, so I'm sure we did do lots of history, but it was sort of part of larger project. Secondary school was a fairly standard trip through from 1066 through to the Nazis that most school boys would have had, and I can remember certain key things out of that. Yes.
But the special teachers who were good, what were the sort of things they were doing that really engaged you?
Well, I always remember Martin, and as I say, he's somebody I know well. I can remember his very large model of Newcastle Keep that was made painstakingly out of probably quite un-PC these days, probably I think from cigarette boxes, you know, the large, not the small packets of cigarettes, but the large boxes that packs used to come in, and this thing dismantled to show in quite some detail the interior of, now I know that he was, this was his first teaching post. This was his first ever teaching job, and he'd obviously come out from college and uni and what have you, and this was probably a project he'd done as what we'd call today a PGCE student. Well, I don't know whether that was the correct parlance for those days. I can remember that in detail. I can remember going out on visits and looking at local history. We went to the local church, there's Motton Bailey Castle, the remains thereof, in my local town, right in the middle of the town, so we did that. So yes, there are certain particular things that stood out from there. I had a very talented teacher when I did my O-level, who was very good at engaging us. I'm very good at questioning, very, very good at engaging us in questioning and getting us to formulate our own questions. Something we spend a lot of time these days trying to get children to do, which is formulate their own historical questions. Well, she used to be able to do this effortlessly, purely by, it's the only way you got relief from writing huge amounts of notes and copying them off the board. If you could ask a good question that engaged her, then she would stop long enough to answer that question, so you could stop writing. Really, it trained us to try and come up with as many pertinent questions as we possibly could. So she was very good at that, what I think is a key aspect of that dialogue that a good history teacher engages in, that was quite unusual then, in the sense that most of, you know, it wasn't unusual when I say copying out notes, that was the usual fare for virtually every single O level that I did. That was what you did in class, you copied notes from the board. So she, her lessons were different in that respect, because you knew you could stop doing that, and she would engage you in questions, and you'd almost be playing question tennis in a sense, which was intellectually, I think, quite stimulating if I look back on it.
What topics were you studying for O-level?
O-level, yes, we did standard modern world affairs, Russian, early Russian history, so Russian Revolution, the New Deal, of course, Nazi Germany, I think we did Mussolini, can't remember now, I think we did a bit of Italian history, but fairly standard modern world affairs, sort of fair.
So why did you decide to become a history teacher? What were the key influences on your choice?
I suppose when I was at school, I loved learning English, and that was probably my favourite subject until I got into upper school and started doing my O-levels, and then decided that I actually loved history even more. So that was the point at which I suppose I started to develop a real liking for the subject, and sort of fascination for the subject. And I suppose from that point onwards, when I at sixth form, I suppose I started to think about in terms of careers. You tended to think quite early about careers in those days, because it was basically, you know, your parents were, they would support you whilst you're in full-time education, and once you finish full-time education, you go to work. So it was a thought. And I suppose I had two things. My father had been in the services, so one aspect or one part of me had sort of ideas about joining up, and the other part of me had ideas about teaching. I don't know why teaching. I think possibly because I was quite, some of my teachers were very personable, very good, and it was something that that appealed to me, and that I quite enjoyed learning myself, and therefore the idea of getting other people to learn with me was something that appealed to me.
And you went to teacher training college, did you?
I did, yes.
And after that, you embarked on your career.
I did.
So how did you actually learn to teach history?
Very interesting. Yeah, very interesting that. We were supposed to be taught how to teach our main subject. So my degree was split into two. We followed my history lecturing was, or the history part of the degree was pretty much the standard fare that students who were doing a joint honours degree would have followed. So if you were doing English and history, basically what we did is we did the history element of that, and then the other side of our degree was education studies, and so we studied the philosophy and sociology, psychology and so forth of education, did teaching practice, all the rest of things, and then part of that was a sort of set of experiences that were supposed to be about teaching our main special, or our main field, which was sort of a crossover really, because it was where people who were actually really history lecturers but had some background perhaps themselves in teaching in the dim and distant past, and remember their dim and distant past was the 1950s, taught us, I think really probably how they were taught history. I don't think it really I think it was fairly ad hoc, and so I had a lecturer who had been at Oxford and had a very traditional history background. His tutor had been Elton, and his idea of history had been then, I think, that had been then forged in the 1950s in maybe his first grammar school teaching experience, and I don't think it had changed much beyond that. And I can remember going into towards the end of my degree, HMI were just starting to look at publishing, and I can't remember the name of the document, it's a blue booklet on basically broadening history out and looking at a more skills-based approach. And obviously SHP had by that time was in its infancy, and because I was friends with my ex-history teacher. He was feeding me some of these things. He was looking at something called the Manchester History Project at the time, because he was obviously he was by that time head of faculty. I was quite interested in this because it tended to... one of the things I'd found as the ultimate irony was that every stage you got to in your education, you were told to forget what you'd learned in the stage you were just finished. So you got to O-level, you started your first A-level lesson was, well, forget everything you learned at O-level. And your first lesson at degree was, well, forget everything you learned at A-level. And it seemed to be a little bit counterproductive to me in the idea that possibly it might be better if actually perhaps we could have more of a continuity of learning. And SHP definitely seemed to provide the answer to that, in the sense that it said, well, let's start unpicking on what history is about. Also, as an undergraduate, you're learning more about what the subject is about. So you, instead of just studying history, you're learning more about the methodology that the historians employ. You're learning more about the philosophy of the subject and what the subject is about. And it seemed to me that was lacking from what we were teaching children, or what I was being trained to teach children. But his response was less than positive when I came along. I can remember presenting a paper to a tutorial in the days when you only had about 4 students in a tutorial group, not 400. I think being held up to ridicule was probably a fairly accurate description of how he responded to it. So I don't think that there was anything in my training per se that, as a history teacher, that led me to taking a different view, other than sort of transference of knowledge, you know, going in and doing what was done to me, other than I'd had sort of brief glimpse of it being done differently to me by some teachers. And secondly, I suppose because the other side of what I was doing at college was looking at education, and obviously that was very different, because we were starting to look at, you know, how do children think and learn. And I suppose at this time I was just on the cusp of people moving away from a sort of a more behaviourist to a more cognitive based sort of approach, and definitely looking at learning as a more social... I don't think we got quite as far as fully engaging with Vygotsky, but we definitely had got as far as looking at spiral curriculums and thinking more about Bruner. And so that sort of transference of knowledge doesn't really sit very easily when you're being taught about those sorts of theories of learning. So also, so as part of me was also looking for, how do you sort of marry up those two? How do I sort of make more sense of what I'm beginning to understand about maybe how children think and learn, and relating that to my subject? And again, things like SHP probably started to tick quite a few of those boxes.
So when you went into your first job, how long did it take you to feel confident in the classroom?
Well, because I'd done a 4-year degree course, and throughout that time we had done teaching practices throughout, I have to say, probably far too confident already. I'd also had the advantage that my last school, when we did almost a term's teaching practice, there was then a member of staff who was unwell, who had to have some time off, and I was able to go in on a weekly basis and teach, and I did a bit of PE teaching and I did a bit of history teaching. But that's because that's what that person's timetable was, which was quite good. And that was my first school, and so a job, not his job, but somebody else's job came up. They'd moved on at the end of that year, and the head called me in one day and said, look, this post is coming up, would you like to apply for it, along with the other 100 or so people who probably applied for it. I was very lucky enough to get an interview and get the job. So I was actually quite, probably more confident than the normal NQT of today, in the sense that I'd spent a lot of time teaching, but B, I'd spent an awful lot of time teaching in that particular school. And I suppose that the course that we were on gave you confidence, in the sense that teaching was at its heart, in the sense that teaching practice was the most important thing in our degree. It was the only thing you couldn't fail. You could fail anything else and resit it. If you failed a teaching practice, you failed your whole degree. So if you failed,
yes. Did anyone do that?
One or two people got close. Not me, I hasten to add. I can say that I struggled with some other aspects of my degree, but not the teaching part of it. But the other part of it was that it was very stringent, and our supervisors came in without warning. So unlike today, where you would know that you were, you had to actually prepare every lesson as though you were going to be observed, because you could be. And I suppose that gave you a sort of sense of confidence, because you had to be able to, you know, if you were teaching for a term, you had to be able to do every lesson as though you were going to have it observed, and so therefore it wasn't any different from going and doing it for real, I suppose, is the honest answer. But probably overconfident is the truthful answer.
Thinking back to those early days in the classroom, what kind of history did you most enjoy teaching, and why?
Well, I suppose A level, really, because it was the bit of my life that I'd found most difficult. I'd found the transition when I'd gone to studying A level was quite difficult, moving from a school to a sixth form situation hadn't really suited me for all sorts of reasons. And anyway, so going to teaching A level for me was quite different, because obviously there wasn't a lot of age difference. I actually had an upper sixth that I inherited from the person who'd left. So I was teaching people who, I mean, I was, what, 23, 24, and they were 18, 19. There wasn't a great deal of difference. So that was very different, because obviously in all my teaching practices, I mean, nobody ever let you loose with their sixth form when you were a student. So I'd been used to teaching mainly lower school. So I suppose just for the contrast. And also it was the nearest, it was pure history in the sense that, in a sense, you were teaching from, you know, there weren't any textbooks for A-level at that point in time, so you were teaching from the same text that I'd used as an undergraduate and trying to translate those for A-level students. So in a sense, that was probably the most exciting challenge, because it was something I hadn't done. I hadn't done on teaching practice or anything else.
Can I ask you about that? Because you talked about more exciting ways of teaching SHP. Mm. Did you actually teach your sixth formers in any way different to how you've been taught?
Not at all. Not, of course I didn't. Don't be silly. I taught them exactly the same way as I'd been taught. And I think the saving grace was that they were a very small group. This was an all-boys school, and the sixth form was made... We used to do a joint sixth form with a local girls' school. So the sixth form was mixed in the sense that the children actually travelled between the two sites and did their A-level studies in a mixture of two sites. So they didn't wear uniform. They were obviously a little bit older in that sense. But no, I religiously stuck to what I knew best, and I taught them in the best traditions of didactic teaching. But I have to say, it really was much more discussion-led, because, you know, you've got, I think, I don't know the exact numbers, but there were probably no more than 7 or 8 students in the group. So actually it was quite informal, really, and the age difference wasn't that great, and it was a little bit more relaxed times those days. And I do remember taking them down the pub afterwards, and of course, obviously, you would never do that now, and you'd be struck off, and the GTC would be speaking to you and all sorts of things, but, you know, hey-ho.
Thank you very much. Can you remember what syllabuses you were teaching before the national curriculum came in at that school, isn't it?
Yes, I can. Yeah, we were teaching the American and Russian A-level. And I think it was AEB, but I couldn't swear to that. Not that it probably makes a lot of difference, but it was my head of department taught the American history, and I taught the Russian history. So we just split them between us, so we both had an upper and a lower six as we went through. Then at CSE, and this may sound really old, isn't it? At CSE at O level, we were teaching social and economic. And I can't remember the board, but my guess is it was probably the same. It's probably AEB, but I wouldn't swear to that.
And lower down the school, what sort of thing did you do?
Lower down the school, this is where we had fun, because that was my playground. Lower down the school is that basically, because he was head of sixth form and I was nominally the second in department, it was quite a large department. It was we had about well, we had at least four full-time historians plus at least two members of staff who taught, so that, who taught half a time table. There was one teacher who taught economics, and obviously that was only taught at O level and beyond, so his lower school timetable was history, and one lady who taught English and history, so she had a split timetable. So we had the equivalent, you know, so, but nominally the role I had filled was the second in department's role, which was quite nice. So I had basically control over the lower school syllabus in the pre-national curriculum days, and so I could do what I wanted with it. So basically I just put all the resources that I could find and anything else, and experimented with doing source-based history.
From year seven upwards?
Oh yeah, from year seven. Well, it wasn't year seven then, it was the first, second and third years, yeah, so...
Well, can you remember what sort of topics, which materials were you using?
Well, basically, no, basically we had a whole range of different things. I don't even remember the suitcase mystery booklets that came out. So we had those that we sort of incorporated into year seven, into a sort of what is history, what we call a what is history unit or whatever it is these days. And then basically I was dictated by the resources we had. So whatever resources we had, is that's what I sort of put things around. So I can't remember exactly what we did, but I remember doing some stuff about the Tudors featured in there quite a lot, and the Civil War, there was quite a bit on the Tudors and the Civil War, only purely because that's what we had resources, and it was bits of textbooks and bits of this, so I was trying to sort of incorporate the bits of it that I could take out of more mainstream resources that I could use as source based material. And obviously, you know, we were coming into the range of where we could actually use video. I mean, you know, we did have a video player, so there were lots of programs and things that we could use as well, and that's basically what we did. We sort of played with it, really. And
so it wasn't a chronological overview course.
I think it probably ran roughly chronologically. Yes, I think I tried to keep a rough sort of chronology. I remember there being Saxons or something in year seven, followed by, you know, with the what is history thing, and then it's a long time ago to remember exactly what we were teaching. And I do remember, I think year eight was probably that Tudor and Stuart bit, and then probably in year nine we went on to do looking at 20th century. We did something like the First World War. We did a big in-depth project on the First World War in the third year. I don't think we did World War II. Can't remember doing that. So anyway, roughly that's. So I think it ran roughly chronologically, but I don't think chronology was the guiding. I think the resources were the guiding sort of ways of what we went with.
Were the pupil activities in the classroom a lot different as well?
Yeah, I tried to make them a lot different. I can remember us trying to get students to take a lot of resources and work their way through sources and come up with sort of conclusions based upon, in a very rough and rudimentary way, them trying to actually do what today we call an inquiry, as opposed to actually learning about things. So we sort of have some key lessons on something to introduce it, and then we'd try and open it up and get kids. I can remember them having piles and piles of books in front of them and trying to work their way through all these different things around particular questions, as opposed to working through textbooks.
And would they work in groups on those?
Yeah, so there'd be group work, there'd be individual work, there'd be pair work, yeah, that sort of thing, yeah.
But given that obviously they were going to move up into O level,
yes,
or CSE,
yes,
did you actually develop the skills for that as well?
Well, I think we had in mind that we knew that GCSE was going to change, because this was 1985, and GCSE we knew that it was going to happen. We knew that there was going to be a skills paper. So my head of department was very keen, because he thought that I probably knew much more about this approach to learning than he did. I don't know where he got that idea from, but he obviously thought I did, because I was, just by virtue of the fact that I was a lot younger than him. So that was that. I think that was the thinking behind it, that we were quite well versed in delivering the information bit of it, because that's how it's always been done. But what was the big unknown was this skills paper, and what that was going to look like, and how we were going to prepare students for that. So I think he was quite keen that Key Stage, well, what was going to become Key Stage 3, was going to be much more source-based to prepare them for that aspect of the GCSE, or of the new GCSE as it was going to be.
That brings us very neatly onto GCSE.
Yes.
So, I mean, it introduced evidence work. It also introduced this idea of empathy into history teaching.
Yes.
So how did that affect your teaching?
Well, not by that time. We were well into it because empathy was one of the big things that drove what we were doing in lower school, because a lot of the activities we were doing were fairly crude empathy type tasks that we would fairly shudder up today probably, and that I wouldn't do as crudely hopefully, but it was quite a large part of it. So put yourself in the shoes of Elizabeth I and Howard, you know, whatever it might be. That's so I think we were quite confident that we were going the right direction. Secondly, we had an HMI visit from the chief HMI at the time, the chief history HMI. All Gloucester schools were given a history HMI visit, I think. I don't think we were just singled out for being completely poor. So he had been in and spent quite a lot of time with us, and had spent quite a lot of time in my classroom, and seemed to be unable to be able to hold a clipboard for very long, and seemed to be very keen on team teaching. So I spent a week of my life with, you know, and we got quite a positive feedback about what we were doing in lower school. So we felt fairly, by the time GCSE came along, we did feel fairly confident that we were going in the right way, going in the right direction, I think is how he'd given us our feedback.
When your first cohort got their results, did that prove you were correct?
I don't know. We didn't seem to take much view about what the results were like. I can't ever remember sitting down and discussing what the results were like. We just did it, and the results, I don't think people really got very exercised about how many people actually passed or anything. We did with A level, but not with O level and CSE or GCSE. But yeah, I think the first set of GCSE results were better than what we'd had when we'd had the mix of CSE and O level, but it was difficult to make a comparison, to be honest with you, because you know, CSE groups, particularly in a school, which it was quite a difficult school in some respects. I mean, it was you know, in the sort of centre of Gloucester, it was a had a reputation of being quite a tough school. So the lower school, you sort of got children then opting to do history. The CSE groups were, there wasn't a great deal of emphasis put on the results, more about whether or not were children behaving and were they actually doing what they should be doing in the classroom. And as long as that was going on, then I suppose nobody really looked very closely at results. We'd had an HMI visit, we'd got a clean bill of health. What more?
Interesting. Isn't it compared with today?
Oh, very much so. There was no data. There was no, you know, people were starting to think about that. And after their results, I had a brief sojourn outside of teaching for 3 years. So when I came back into teaching after that, I came back into a pre-existing national curriculum, which obviously the person who'd been sitting in my classroom had, in the meantime, been in his spare time written.
So you then went to City Technology College?
I did, yes. After, I say, a brief sojourn in publishing. And, so I went to Kent, to a much larger school, to coordinate humanities. So a different sort of set of challenges. When we were starting to grapple with data on a big time, yes. Value added, even.
Most commentators agree the national curriculum did have a big effect on history teaching. So, in your experience, you know, did it have a big effect on your teaching, and was it for better or worse?
Yes, I think, in a sense, I'm probably quite well placed because I had 3 years out between 88 and, you know, 91, which is the time when it was implemented. I could actually see the difference very starkly because I hadn't been in the sort of transition between the two. And yes, it did make a difference because you were, you had a very clear, you know, what you were teaching was no longer a matter that you had to worry about. But you did have to worry about how you were teaching it. And so it put the emphasis more on pedagogy and less on worrying about should we teach about the First World War, or should we teach about the Second World War, or should we teach about the Boer War, or should, and which bit of history should we leave out, and which, you know, and that internal argument the history departments could get into. Well, it took all that out of it. You no longer had to worry about that. You were told what you were going to teach. And I think the downside of it was that when I first went there, the person who was heading the history department thought that a scheme of work was something you photocopied out of the programme of study. So, thought, well, that's, you know, that doesn't really, that tells me what I'm going to teach. What about the how? And so we did have just, but it did, I think the thing it did focus you on, particularly as a middle leader, was that you really had to get into, right, you know, how are we delivering learning? How are we structuring children's learning? What are we actually doing? What are the activities we're doing? How does that match with what we're trying to get them to learn? And so, as I say, that the emphasis was much more on the pedagogy.
Is that because of the attainment targets? Because it specified what it wanted.
Well, you had a progression to work with for the first time ever. In terms of assessment in lower school. You know, we all know that we were assessing children against GCSE grades or GCE grades or whatever grades that we were using, you know, when we were teaching A-level or whatever else. And we all had a fair idea of what that might look like at the end product. But in lower school, you know, basically you were giving grades on was their work pretty, effort, and trying maybe to, you know, you were grappling with, well, how do I give credit to the sorts of thinking I'm trying to get children to establish? I think that the HMI document that had come out in 85, 86 had preempted history. There'd been a lot of discussions about what the national curriculum should look like. I think compared to a lot of the other subjects, we were very lucky in the person who actually penned our local our key stage three, and I think we came out of it pretty well. I think that the it wasn't perfect, and there were a lot of things that were, you know, there was too much content, you know, but I think that it was not a bad thing for history teaching, and I think it pretty much just actually took what we were doing at GCSE into lower school in a sense. So we were already starting to think about, you know, developing skills for the skills papers and so forth. And I think it just took all that down into lower school and gave us a framework that many of us had already started to sort of pretty much try and struggle towards anyway. So I don't think it was a bad thing. I think the problem wasn't necessarily the national curriculum in history. The problem was the national curriculum in everything else and the fragmentation that it brought to the curriculum, and I felt that because obviously I was now trying to run humanities, so I didn't have to just, you know, I had the geography national curriculum and the complete lack of anything national curriculum in RS to worry about, and trying to draw those together. And what we were trying to do was draw certain units of work where children studied across the three subjects, so that there were units of work that brought together what they were doing in the various different humanities disciplines. So that was quite difficult because you were trying to look for what were the commonalities between, say, geography. The RS wasn't so difficult because you were freer, but what was the commonalities between the geography? And that was the thing that struck me, was that what hadn't been enough work put in place in terms of looking at the commonality of learning that runs through all of the subjects. It pushed too many subjects apart, and I think we still feel some of that today when I go into certain subject areas and they tell me, you wouldn't understand this because the learning's totally different in this area than anything you would have experienced, and I nod sagely. I think that is one of the repercussions of that.
Had you done an integrated approach in your previous school before the national curriculum?
No.
But in the CTC, you were being asked to create one.
Yeah.
And did you manage to do it?
Yeah. Yeah, we what we did was we kicked off our units of work with an integrated study. So, for instance, we had an old gunpowder mill at the end of the field, just in some overgrown bushes that nobody had, it's been all restored now. One of about the three major gunpowder producing places in Elizabethan England. So that was ideal because we could actually draw together our geography, which was our local map work and all the rest of it. There were some quarries that were now lakes, so we could bring in the whole idea of looking at nature. And I don't know how we managed to get RS in it. We managed to get RS in it somehow, some creative way. But the geography and the history, for instance, in that project, were really easy to sort of marry up. There was an integrated unit like that kicked off each of the core units. Then they went back, they spent maybe a couple of weeks doing that, then they went off and did their geography and their history specifically.
With their specialist teachers.
Right. But remember, this is the time when also history was... It was compulsory that you did a humanities at GCSE. And I had in our faculty, the biggest problem was the fact that geography wasn't very popular. So I think we had two groups. And this is a 1,300 kids in this school. We had two groups doing geography and everybody else was doing history. Well, you can imagine the amount of history that we were having to teach. And we had A-level as well. So my time was taken up. I didn't teach much outside of GCSE and my two A-level groups. That was about my timetable full. You know, there were knock-on problems, and on the integrated units, what we were trying to do was trying to get children a bit more enthused. Actually, ironically, I was trying to get children more enthused about geography, which is quite ironic, really, considering my later career. I was desperately trying to get children less enthusiastic about geography and more enthusiastic about history, but there you go.
Why do you think that history was so much more popular with the children than geography? Was it the staff?
I don't know. I think it was to do with the school. The school was an amalgamation of an old school with new children in it. So it had a mixture of members of staff from the existing school and members of staff who'd come in from all over the place. All the historians were sort of new teachers, and all the geographers were members of staff from the older school. And, you know, it's always greener on the other side of the fence as far as kids are concerned when it comes to options, and probably just that. But it was the case that geography was not well considered, and it could have been just through the history of the school and all sorts of reasons. Geography wasn't badly taught, you know. It wasn't a poorly taught subject. We all taught in the same suite of rooms, so we all had the same access to the same resources and so forth, you know, in terms of the physical resources in the faculty. So it was nothing to do with that, just a historical thing.
And given that it was a CTC, were the technology facilities really wizard?
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, we had a basement in which there was a machine which they made £10 notes. And so money was no... I'm not joking. I had never taught in a school where money was literally no object. You wanted it, the cheque was signed. It was absolutely fabulous. I didn't even have a budget. I didn't even bother. It wasn't a budget. It was just like...
So what sort of things were you spending the money on?
Well, we had I think they spent about £5 million putting in a new ICT system. And this is £5 million in 1991. Yeah, quite. You probably would buy two schools for that then. So we had a suite of computers at the end of our corridor of 30 machines, brand spanking new, state of the art for then. So we could use that whenever we wanted to. We had two classrooms knocked into one, which was called our forum. So we had a massive room that we could use for whatever activities we want to do. I can remember us having, we had a Roman market in there, because we were studying the Romans. And the kids brought in all their foods and what have you. And again, that had ICT facilities in it as well. We had ICT facilities in the classroom. In addition to that, we had two or three machines in each room. Yeah, it was quite different.
So were you really making a lot of use of ICT?
Yeah,
what
yeah.
What
sort
of things were the children doing with the computers?
Well, I mean, it was basically word processing, and we had one or two programs, sort of ancient programs that we'd used, because we were teaching GCSE SHP by this time as well. So We had some programmes, I don't know if you remember them, Wagons West, everyone remembers them. There were a couple of programmes in that ilk. There was one on the plague, wasn't there, if you remember rightly. And so we were trying to use using things like that as well. Remember these, I mean, compared to today, these computers, you give it space on your desk today. So it was basically word processing. We also were experimenting with using things like Excel to put data onto, to look at sort of changes over periods of time. So we did a project on doing something, I can't even remember what it was now, but where we were using numerical data from something, which I can't remember even what it was, where the kids were putting it onto Excel spreadsheets and then turning it into graphs and things, so they could then decide and change. It was something like that, cholera epidemics or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something where you could put, it was easy to transpose in numerical data and then present it as a graph, and then of course you could start to use that to help you make conclusions about whether the water was getting cleaner or whatever it was that we were doing. But we were starting to play around with those sorts of things.
Did you
as
have
well.
TV and video in every room?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, there was. Well, we had them on trolleys, but we basically had TV and video in every room. There wasn't. I can never remember a situation where I had wanted TV and video and couldn't have it because somebody else was using it. There were enough that there was more than we needed. Yeah. Yeah.
And A-level teaching, had that moved on as well?
No, that was exactly the same. Except it was social economic. So I'd done a complete reversal. I was where I'd started off teaching O-level social economic, I was now teaching A-level social economic and SHP at GCSE. Now I was doing it the other way around. So, but yes, no, I was doing that. And obviously, because the CTC was quite keen on staff development, I was examining both. I was examining SHP paper two, which was the medicine skills paper. Well, it wasn't the medicine skills paper then, it was whatever, it was the skills paper, because at that point they just did, it was the unsee skills paper, it became the medicine skills paper. And I was examining A level as well, just in case I had any spare time for anything else.
So what do you think now about the way in which history has gone, the revisions to the curriculum?
Obviously, you know, the Deering revisions, which was started to free up this content-led thing. I think, in terms of, I think it's the wider developments like AFL that give us the greatest scope, because they take us away from, I mean, that terrible knocking out tick lists in the early 90s for progression. You know, what level were children at? Oh, I don't know. Let's just tick this box. All that really has been the major issues. I think that a lot of the pedagogical journey that history teachers, or many history teachers, took in the late 80s, early 90s, I think they're demolishing the school.
Well,
no, that's all right, sorry.
Right, so pick up now.
Where did I get to? What we were talking about, sorry.
Tick list for progression.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that those things are difficult, and I think where we've now moved on to is the sort of pedagogical journey, as I say, that we made as history teachers, I think a lot of other people are having to make. We made it because of the pressure on justifying our subject, you know, in a competitive world, history had to justify its position on the curriculum, and I think a lot of history teachers felt that acutely. Other colleagues have now had to make those pedagogical jumps. So I think in terms of assessment, we're in a much better place. We're in a much better place in terms of the content, in the fact that we don't really have any content. We can really pick and choose in terms of flexible or what we do. I think the big problem now is the squeeze on the curriculum. It isn't the history itself. I think we're perfectly excited to deliver very good quality history learning. But the problem is now, are we going to get the time to do it as everything else squeezes into the curriculum? And I think that's particularly apt to Key Stage 4, is because we're competing with vocational subjects and everything from, you know, everything that's going to come in or not come in the next few years, BTECs and all the rest of it. And that, because they are double moduled or treble moduled or quadruple moduled in some cases, i.e. they're two, three or four GCSEs, when a student opts for that, they've basically taken all their options. And that means they haven't the flexibility to say, oh, well, yes, I'll do history, but I'll also do that, and I'll also do that. And that's the threat at the moment, other than whatever I think the dangerous point of I think the danger in that at the moment is us getting very desperate about lacking time to teach history or lacking space on the curriculum to teach it, and then selling ourselves to the souls to the devil on the basis of what history's for, when I think we are at a dangerous cusp of time where there is this element of within definitely government who I think would like to see the purpose of teaching history as some sort of extension of citizenship, where it's about people learning the story of their nation in order for people to feel that they've got some sort of sense of community and belonging. Now, I don't underestimate history's power to do that, but I think it's a very dangerous step to take in that we have to ask ourselves, whose history are we? Are we actually getting children to learn? Are we going away from a more open and inquiry-based approach to learning history, where we say to children, you know, the past and history are not the same. History changes, the past obviously doesn't. History is about our interpretations, and what we want to do is learn about how those interpretations are formulated and how we can interpret different interpretations ourselves, and how we can draw our own interpretations and make our own minds up about what we think based upon a body of evidence, to a this is what happened in Britain's great imperial past, and you should learn these key moments in time because they will tell you how your nation's been shaped. And I think for me personally, I feel that's a very dangerous step. I'm not quite sure I want to sell my soul just for a space on the curriculum.
I wanted to ask you, actually, because you implied that during the period when you were head of humanities and all your students had to take history or geography and you had an overwhelming number choosing history, that created a problematic position. You almost implied that it was better for history to be in the options, if you like, to have to struggle for students' allegiance.
Yes.
If it was changed so that history was a compulsory element up to 16, would you think that would be disadvantageous, deleterious for history?
I think so. I think it's very nice to think that you would have that lovely safe student numbers. I think the disadvantage of it is that you open yourself up to being told what history is, and having to teach history from a particular perspective, because the purpose of it being, because the only reason I can think of having history as a compulsory subject is that you see history as having a different purpose from the one which we believe that it has at the moment, which is about opening minds. And that purpose is about closing minds. It's about saying, as I say, it's about saying, you know, we want everybody in this country to have had the same experience of learning about the same things in the same way, because it's about them building a picture of our country's past that enables them to develop a sense of belonging, as I said before, or a sense of understanding. I think that, for me, that fundamentally misreads what the basic tenet of history is about. History is a subject which is about questioning, it's about challenging, it's about revising what we know. It's not about setting it in stone and saying, you know, this particular view. I had a very interesting discussion with a colleague who had watched Dr. Starkey's programme recently, on DVD obviously, when he states that Mary the First was very popular with women in England at the time, and was asking me, she wasn't a historian, was asking me, you know, how he worked that out. And I had to say, well, he didn't work it, he had made it up. And actually it's incredibly poor history, because frankly it's his view, and he hasn't had not a shred of evidence to support that view. And last time I had the pleasure of listening to Dr. Starkey live, I have to say that Christine Council was sitting about four seats down from me, and she was holding her head in her hands. the rest of us really wanted to chuck stuff at him, but let's not get there. But you can see what I'm saying is I think that that view of it could be very easy to have that sort of view of history prevail in our schools if it becomes delivered, or that it becomes designed centrally. And I think if it becomes delivered as a compulsory unit, you're going to have a lot of non-specialists teaching it. You would have to have, there wouldn't be enough historians in schools to deliver it, and therefore it lends itself even more to being, should I use the word manipulated, but fashioned in a central sort of basement of somewhere in Whitehall by Mr. Gove and his friends, and thereby we could end up with what I would consider to be lessons about stories from the past, reducing history to a study of stories from the past, about the sorts of stories we want people to hear, because we would rather that they learned those stories to sort of somehow shape a national, to have a national story. I feel very uncomfortable about that.
Do you use stories though?
Yeah, narrative is very important, and this is the whole dilemma for historians, isn't it? The narrative is very important, and you know, my year sevens, when I teach about 1066, I start my teaching with about 1066 with Beowulf, which history teacher doesn't, because it's a wonderful story. We talk about the narrative. But, you know, I don't go on then to present them with a picture of medieval England that says to them, there's one lens to look at this through, you know, William the First and the Normans, what a great bunch of people they are, look at the wonderful architecture. Or the other point of view, which is, what a terrible, he wasn't known as William the Bastard for nothing. You know, now there's a number of perspectives about that. What I want my children to do is I want them to be exposed to all of those different interpretations and be able to feel confident enough to explore those different interpretations. I don't want them being told this is what it was, because we have a very nasty, you know, historians, you know, the building of history is about, you know, using what we've got at the moment to tell us about a particular event or people in the past. And, you know, the raw materials that we have at any one time will change. Sometimes they will get better, sometimes they will get worse. We'll have better ways of handling information. You know, what we know about life in Tudor England was transformed by the computer, as was what we thought was the cause of population rise in the Industrial Revolution. When, you know, when I was at school, everyone flooded to the towns, and that's how towns grew. Well, we all know that that's not the case. We know that the population of rural England grew during industrialisation. We know that because we were able to crunch the numbers through our computers. We know that the breakdown of things like, you know, the restrictions on working and age that were working in guilds and so forth, meant that people could start work earlier, have children younger, greater survivability rates, earning more money, better diet, natural increase of population. We could be in Schofield, 1981. But you know, it's and so what do? When do we bring the axe down and say that's it? That's the final interpretation about Dunkirk. It was a defeat. It was a great victory. It was whatever it was, and then we're not going to change it anymore. Well, that's not going to happen in real history. So what you're going to get is a separation between school history and what historians are actually working on and producing and delivering. And so what you're going to get is, ultimately, children being exposed to what they learn at school, then turning the television on and listening to Tristan Hunt telling them something totally different, and going and coming back to the history teacher and saying, well, that's not what you told me. That doesn't happen now, because actually I'd be the first one saying to them, well, look, you know, there's this historian telling you that William was a very skillful leader and won the Battle of Hastings, and there's this historian telling you it's pure luck. So it doesn't matter that they might hear another interpretation about that. It's not going to phase them, because actually it's just another opinion and something else for them to put in their melting pot. But I think, you know, the danger of becoming fixed is, well, I think would ultimately we would end up, yes, with more numbers, But ultimately, I think it would undermine the subject. And ultimately, when inevitably some politician changes their mind and says that it's no longer compulsory, we would get huge numbers of children flooding away from the subject, and we'd be in a worse situation than we are in now.
Thank you. I suppose attached to that is this thing about British history and chronology and national identity.
Yes.
Which a lot of what the critics are saying is they're not in history at the moment. So are they, or should they be?
Well, I don't know if anybody... I mean, you know, to me, anybody who says there's no British history obviously has never read the Key Stage 3 Orders. Because actually, I would say there's too much British history in the Key Stage 3 Orders. I mean, you know, we teach very little other than that. I mean, Year 8 is about the only time you escape from it. And OK, we do call World War 2 and World War 1 world history. But let's be absolutely honest. When we teach it from a very... not even a Eurocentric perspective. We teach it largely from a British perspective. You know, how much time would the average history teacher spend on, let's say, D-Day, and how much time would they spend on the Battle of Stalingrad? Rhetorical question, I know, but I would guess in most schools, most kids would know what D-Day is. In a lot of schools, most kids would have never even heard of Stalingrad, and had we not made a very famous film about it, and they seen it, they wouldn't even know where it was, what it was. You know, okay, I think there's plenty of scope for the development of British history in the current curriculum. I think most schools will be studying some British history. Well, they will do because of the specs at GCSE. There has to be British history in there. Whether you're doing SHP, which we no longer do here, or whether you're doing modern world, social economic, or as what we're doing at the moment, which is the new sort of standalone OCR. What do we call it? Thing that we're doing at the moment.
The pilot
that we're doing. Sorry, yes, that's the word I was looking for. Pilot, GCSE, and within that, you know, you've got a core medieval unit that is basically British history, and then yeah, okay, they get to look at various different other aspects of things, but there's still elements of British history in there. There's site investigation. Inevitably, they'll look at a castle or something British because it's difficult to do a site. I mean, there might be a few schools that are doing it overseas, but. My guess is most will be doing it. So I don't think there's a huge amount of problem in terms of the amount of British history that children can be exposed to. I think the problem is that you've got an overcrowded curriculum. I think that's the problem. And the problem is that you've got, the amount of time that children are actually studying history, along with a lot of other subjects, may I say. You know, it's not just history, this, but a lot of other subjects is being shrunk down year on year. And as we start... You'll go to schools where GCSE starts in year 8. Well, that means they're only getting, even in year 8 or year 9. You know, they may be getting 1 or 2 years of Key Stage, or they could be doing a skills-based curriculum in year 7. So they do no subject-specific stuff there at all. And then they do subject-specific stuff in year 8, and then they start the GCSEs in year 9. So they're getting a year.
So do you
we don't do that. No, we don't do that here because we don't think it's right. But to be absolutely honest with you, you know, our GCSE results, we could improve our GCSE results if we did all those little tricks, and we'd probably make ourselves our lives a lot easier when Ofsted come through the door if we did, as a senior leadership team. Stunned silence.
Sad
but true.
I wanted to ask you about the pilot GCSE and how that's worked in the school.
It's been brilliant. Been very, very good. I can say that I don't teach it. I haven't got to teach it, and that's a good sign. That means that my colleagues love teaching it, and they don't want to stop teaching it. And they, because if they didn't, there's plenty of other things for them to teach that they would want to teach. There's plenty of other things on the curriculum that they could teach. But no, they love teaching this. Particularly, and one of my colleagues who said he was quite sceptical when it was brought in because he thought he was a bit dumbing it down has said to me, not at all. He said it's just more accessible. The kids can access the curriculum, but the standards that we're applying are exactly the same.
What do you mean by more accessible?
Well, if you could, you tell me what the word describe means. Just a juxtaposition. The interview?
To give all the available information you can.
Okay, not according to some GCSE examiners, it's not. The word describe actually means analyse. Don't ask me, but I could dig out past papers with the word describe, whatever it is on it, and then the MART scheme, which has got level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and level 3 is analyse this, level 4 is, oh yes. And I've asked GCSE, I've asked chief examiners, why are you using the word describe when you mean analyse? Oh, the children should be able to work that out themselves. Oh, so if you say put on a blue coat today, and I put on a green, does that mean I've got to put a green coat on? How am I supposed to work this out as the average 15, 16 year old child that actually you don't really mean what you say?
And what's different about the pilot in that respect?
It's straightforward. The access to the assessment is straightforward. The people designing the assessments are the person who's teaching you. So you're not going to produce something in words that your students don't understand. You produce it in a way that is open and accessible for your students. That doesn't mean that you're not, that you're making it easier. You're just making it accessible. The last time I examined, when I stopped, decided to stop examining at GCSE, was when we produced a GCSE paper that had, I think, 15 to 20 closely typed sources on the paper too. I mean, to be honest with you, it was ridiculous, because anybody of middle or low ability was immediately excluded from that exam, not because they didn't understand history, not because they couldn't answer questions on the topic, but because they just couldn't read the stuff in time to be able to have time to answer the questions. A nonsense. And I'm afraid that's been repeated again and again and again. And even when some chief examiners are given the evidence in front of them, we had, by miraculous dint of luck one year, a very open exam where we had very well-worded questions, very accessible paper. And actually what happened was, funnily enough, we got a nice differentiation in terms of outcome. Because you know what, when the children, all the children can understand the question, the bright ones really answer it really well, and the ones who actually struggle a bit more with learning don't answer it quite as well, and the ones who really struggle with learning don't answer it as well as those ones, and you get a nice differentiation. It's easy to mark. When you put a paper together that is so ridiculously worded that actually even we as the examiners can't work out what you meant by the, you know, what you wanted in the answer, funnily enough you get a mishmash of answers where you get able students who just didn't, who misunderstood it, are giving you completely wrong answers. You get a whole mishmash that's ridiculous, and you get some children who write one word on the page and are totally disillusioned with your subject. Outrageous. Should be put up against a wall and shot. No, I don't mean that. But that's exactly what this has avoided. And it means people are examining and people who are teaching have had to work together to construct the course, and that also the calibre of the people who have been involved in putting the whole thing together, people like Chris Colpitt, you know, they know what they're doing. And it shows.
Is it something that would be difficult to replicate on a larger scale?
No, it would be easy to replicate on a larger scale, because actually you've not got loads of people taking an exam all at the same time.
And they take the modules as they go.
They take the modules as they go along. The core part is assessed in an exam where they get a question, and they get 5 hours open book exam. So you get a question on the medieval period, whichever bit, the early or the late, which you've opted to do. You get one essay question, and then the children get 5 hours to sit in the library. They've got access to any resources they want. They can plan, research, and answer their question in that 5 hours. That's done in year 10. So it's out of the way, they know what they've got from it, and also it's giving the teachers a really good sort of idea of where students are in terms of their ability levels and their attainment. And then you've got your centre assessed units, and I can't see any problem with that whatsoever. In fact, the whole thing is done, and by the time they start their other exams, it's all assessed and done. The only issue they've got to get sorted out is the issue of grade boundaries. As you know, when an exam is examined by final exam, as examiners we all standardise and we all apply the criteria in a standardised way. But then the exam board can put all of the results into a big pot and move the grade boundaries around to try and line it up with previous years. It becomes more difficult when you're doing that as a centre assess, because if I've marked something and I know it's a grade C and I've standardised and I've moderated and I know that that is, you know, that student's met the criteria for a grade C, if you then move the grade boundary, they actually go down to a grade D even though they've met the criteria, and that's an issue that the exam board need to get sorted out, because that's, that can be very demoralising for both teachers and students. But that's easily sorted out. That's just people having confidence in the criteria and sticking with it. If they've got confidence that they've got the criteria for the grade boundaries correct, and they've got confidence that they've trained the people in schools and the moderators correctly so that you're getting standardised judgments, then you shouldn't have a need for moving the grade boundary to equate it with previous years, because unlike the other GCSE, where you've got a different paper every year, these kids are doing the same assessment every year.
What, does that not help the following years?
Should do. Shouldn't be any need. It doesn't help the following years, because basic, to be honest with you, any teacher with this sort knows that. I mean, I can give a child an answer to read, doesn't mean they can then go away and construct their own answer. Remember, these are longer pieces of work, so it's not like a short answer question. Yeah, it would be if it was an era series, but you're producing longer pieces of work. You can't really replicate, you couldn't replicate it even if you read somebody else's, because also the stance, the approach you're taking is slightly different from the student the previous year, because it's personalised more to the individual student. So, you know, if I'm doing a report on a particular site investigation, and I'm doing that in terms of, you know, a report to English Heritage about how this site should be managed to the public to protect the historical nature of the site, then actually I might be doing that in a whole totally different ways to the people who've done it before. There hasn't been that problem here with delivering that, but the only issue they've got is those students on the grade boundary that sometimes move up or down, mainly down, when they feel those children have already met the criteria, and that's something the exam board just needs to thrash out with them, really.
Have you had much more success with less able students with this new pilot?
I think in terms of the take up, actually, it's enabled us to sort of develop our Key Stage 3 more in line with that. So children, I think, make their options better informed. It has enabled us... We've always had a good take-up across the ability range here for history since 1994. There's always been a mix. We've never had that problem. There are children here who will do history because they like doing it. They know they're not going to get a grade C or a grade B, but they like doing it. They like the teachers who teach it. The other side of it is that it's pretty well taught here, and children behave, and some children who find difficulty with behaviour actually ironically choose teachers they think they're going to behave with, and so they have chosen history. So we've always had that ability range. Our pass rate has pretty much remained static, within a plus or 10% range. So to me, it hasn't caused grade inflation. And students who do well, and students who don't, you know. And there are children who work really hard on those 2 years and will come out with a grade D or a grade E, you know, or lower. But the difference to me is actually they know where they're going to get. There's no big surprise at the end of it. It's not a big disappointment rush. They know where they're heading to. And actually, if they've chosen the subject because they enjoy doing it, actually the grade becomes immaterial, because actually they enjoy the projects that they're engaged in doing. And it becomes less about the result and less about the grade and more about the process they're engaged in. And that's how it should be. So, no, we haven't had lots of low ability kids miraculously getting GCSEs in history. What we have had is that breadth of ability reflected in the outcome.
Just on a different question, I wanted to ask you whether history should have a moral dimension, and in particular relating to the fact that we have the Holocaust and the slave trade mandated on the national curriculum.
I mean, I think, you know, emotive issues are our bread and butter, aren't they, really, as history teachers? I mean, yes, I mean, could you imagine not teaching about the Holocaust? And yes, it's emotive, and yes, there's a moral dimension to it. You know, we've had our year nines this year listening to Holocaust survivors coming in and talking to them. How could you not have a moral dimension to it? You know, there's a guy standing there with a number tattooed on his arm who's just told you that he's been to Auschwitz and described to you his journey there and what happened to him as a little child, you know, in a death camp. Of course there's a moral dimension to it, and we shouldn't shy away from that. And I know Christine Council has done a lot of work, and SHP have done a lot of work on looking at emotive issues in history teaching. They're incredibly difficult to teach, which is, again, another argument for not having everyone doing history or having one history, because you've got to be incredibly skilled in the classroom to handle those issues sensitively, but at the same time, deal with them in such a way that you can explore the different interpretations. You know, so why are there people who deny that the Holocaust even took place? What, how can we explain that? And that is a question that children often come up with. I think that in terms of looking at the moral issue of them, I think it is about, comes back ironically to that issue that we talked about right at the start, with that sort of empathy issue in history, is that it's about teaching children to empathise rather than sympathise and know the difference between the two. And understand that when they're studying history, that they can look at issues that have a huge moral impact, and are, you can't separate that out from them, but at the same time trying to engage with those subjects with a degree of objectivity, and look at those subjects and try and think about them in terms of how does our language shape how we think of things. So we've done quite a lot of work with some students looking at loaded language. So, you know, we have deliberately, you know, sort of banned, okay, we're doing Hitler, right, first lesson number one, anybody calling Hitler evil, that's banned. The word evil is banned from this lesson. There's no use of the word evil. So now you've got to come up with some other ways to actually articulate your understanding of Hitler's views about race, for instance. Now that's actually quite interesting, because if you take those emotive bits of language out of it, students have to find a different language to explain their understanding. So then you put children, then you say, you take them the next step and say, okay, right, now we're going to hot seat, and we're going to have, you know, we're going to have Hitler there, and you're going to be Hitler. All of a sudden, you've got to be able to empathise, because you've got to, you know, you're going to, students are going to ask them questions about the final solution, and you're going to have to give Hitler's answer, which is not going to be, no, it's a terrible thing, and I really shouldn't have done it.
Well, you wonder whether sometimes you could be straying into dangerous territory, because yes, if you allow Hitler to justify himself,
absolutely,
you could have students who sympathise with that.
Absolutely, you could. So it's important that, again, it comes down to those viewpoints and those interpretations. It comes down to how do you put that into context with a series of interpretations. So do you also have somebody else hot seating who would take a very different view? Do you do that in the context of them listening to a Holocaust survivor talking about, you know, giving a different perspective? How do you place those different things into context? You know, will you be surprised at how sophisticated the average Year 9 student can be in their thinking? My Year 9 students, I've got a middle ability group, I have not got a top group, middle ability group of children in Essex have done some brilliant work this year on those sorts of issues, and they are able to unpick it, and they are able to make the distinction between and actually, in a sense, get a greater understanding, I think, of things like the final solution, because they've moved away from this evil thing, this one-off thing, to a view of, actually, you know, the causes, we can explain the causes of this event, we can unpick it, and that might help us to understand it better. And actually that might help us to understand how we behave and our part that we play in terms of, you know, these things continuing on in the world in which we live. So I think that my students surprise me continually in their ability to sometimes understand the most difficult topics, and sometimes surprise me in their inability to get their head around some of the more straightforward things that can be very frustrating. But that's the joy of teaching.
We did talk about the importance of technology when you were working at the CTC. Mm. Now you're working here in a less technologically endowed situation.
Yeah.
But does technology play a big part in history teaching today?
I think the fact is that most of my colleagues will want to have a very firm view that it's a tool. It's a tool that they can use, and it's a very useful tool. I think sometimes we're quite frustrated in the sense that sometimes the tool doesn't quite deliver the consistency that we need in order to deliver. We have an interesting situation with our internet provider. We have to have the local authority, who frankly couldn't provide chips in the local chip shop, providing us with an internet service that has a tendency to just go always at the point when you want to use it in your lesson. you know, I would have got, I mean, I have no problem with my internet provision at home. I live 2 miles down the road and my internet never crashes and never goes. However, we don't have the same. So I think there is that issue. There is the issue that I think as a school we haven't quite got the mix right, and I think we haven't avoided the problem of usually the people who drive provision of ICT in school are those who teach ICT. And a surprise, if you go to the ICT teaching rooms, they're fab. If you go to the other rooms that have got ICT in them, like the faculty rooms, they're the cast-offs. They're the machines that they no longer want to use. And they're not quite so good. And the kids know that, and therefore you have problems. I don't think it's something we've cracked yet, and it's probably we will never crack it, because it all comes down to money, and there's never enough money to provide for everybody's ICT needs. Where ICT is available, we use it. My colleagues we book ICT rooms whenever we can. They're block booked for GCSE ICT teaching and various other things. We get the second, but as soon as they're available, we're in there. And I know I block booked for my year nines who just done their assessment on World War II, and they used ICT, and it gives them a flexibility about how they want to present what they've understood to an audience. And I think that's a key part of what we do. We don't use it enough.
Do you use electronic whiteboard for presentations?
We have very few of them. We have very few interactive whiteboards, so we use projectors for presentations all the time. Every classroom's got those in it, so we can do that. And there's a level that you can use that interactively, and I've seen that done very well. But there's a limit that an electronic whiteboard would give you another sort of step further. But you live within the world. History teachers are very good at adapting to what they've got. And just because you haven't got ICT doesn't mean that the lessons can't be engaging and exciting and different. To be honest with you, and there are areas in the school that are better endowed with us with ICT, and if you talk to students, as I do as part of my student voice duties and research that I've done, actually the teaching is less engaging, less exciting. So draw your own conclusions.
We've talked already about the way in which vocational options are squeezing the time available for history.
Yes.
Is that something that's happening in the school here?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Inevitably so. We used to, for many years, prior to the vocational expansion, about half the children in the school did history at GCSE, give or take, roughly speaking. We're now down to slightly lower than that. There's about 3 GCSE groups in any year, which is still not unhealthy. And I do say that, to balance that, we've got a much fairer and more open option system. We basically have, the children have got a free option. We basically work our timetable around their options, not timetable, and then they opt. So we really have to survive in a big option group. You know, we're not, it's not an option between geography, history, RS, and maybe one other. It's a massive block. You know, we're competing with art and all sorts of subjects. So I think history does pretty well in a school like this, which is, you know, in terms of ability level, we've got a profile that is mid to low. So I think that it still actually does compete very well. But children will follow what they want. And as the squeeze comes on, it's not so much the curriculum time, because, as I say, we don't work it out like that. But as more children opt for subjects that have a, that carry a larger amount of time for their delivery, that's the threat point, then obviously that's going to squeeze lots of other subjects out of the curriculum. Because if I'm choosing a subject that has carries four GCSEs, and it's got the time of four GCSEs, then those children in the past would have had another three subjects that they're no longer following.
And it tends to be the less able students that are choosing the diplomas and vocational options.
I think it's a mix. I think that's gradually breaking down, because I think a lot of the new diplomas, we're starting the creative diploma this summer, and I think that will appeal to students across the board. It's actually a very good course. It sounds like a very, very good course. If you were thinking about going into media, if you were thinking about anything, then actually you'd be quite tempted to go for it. I know if I was a student at that age and I looked at that course, I think that actually sounds really quite good. You're going to college, you're doing some of those technical things, you're able to use, you know, you're able to access equipment that we don't possess, because you've got onto that, and so therefore you're going to go after the local sixth form college that do have those facilities, and you're going to be able to access that on your course. I could see the attraction of that.
But then are you limiting your opportunities at A level?
Oh yes, and I say that to students, you know, you know the less subjects you do, but you know, to be honest with you, numbers speak everything. Once more students take those options, the A level providers, the sixth form colleges, will adapt their courses to suit that, because they're not going to turn people away. They need to fill up their college to pay the bills, so they're going to merely adapt the courses they're offering to match what students are coming to the front door with in terms of their qualifications. So the pathways, and I think that's already broken down in that, I think the pathway planning anyway is now drawing together schools and sixth form providers anyway. They're co-planning it. So I don't think that will be an issue, but it will be an issue for, say, A-level history and A-level subjects like history, because I can see a lot of those colleges in the future looking at whether or not the groups are too small to run those traditional A-levels, and whether or not we move into a more flexible sort of curriculum where you have elements of, say, history within other wider studies.
Finally. If you could choose any historical topic to teach, what would it be, and to what age group?
You know, I looked at this and I thought, oh, that's an impossible question to actually answer. But I think, and I had lots to choose from, and I thought, well, you know, I loved teaching Russian history at A level, and I'd love to go. Social and economic history at A level was fabulous to teach. And then, you know, teaching about World War II, my year nines, I've had a fabulous year this year nine during the 20th century. Year nine group have been absolutely superb. But I think, if I was being absolutely honest, and I think if you spoke to any of my colleagues, they probably wouldn't even hesitate. They would say, oh God, yes, 1066, and the end of Anglo-Saxon England and the early Norman period to year seven would probably be where he's like a pig in muck.
Thank you very much. We'll finish.
Very welcome.